Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We're coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. I'm stepping in for Peter Clody.
We've been having political harassment of Botswana Patriotic Front activists. This has started, if you recall, we had a by-election. And now they've come in and they've started all this witch hunt, and that they're using the Secret Service, which we call here the BIS.
In Botswana, the main opposition Patriotic Front, BPF, is expressing concern about arrests of political opponents.
Secondhand clothing that comes into the country will at some point reach the end of life and need to be recycled, and that's an opportunity for new domestic textile producers. But also, you know, the skills that are being used are in some ways complementary, whether you're dealing with secondhand clothes or you're dealing with new domestic textile production.
And a new report calls for East African countries to avoid protectionism against the import of secondhand clothing.
Africa needs to be in space. There's no choice, in my view. Being behind in that area costs African nations quite a lot.
A veteran NASA space scientist says that Africa needs to invest more in space exploration. We'll have those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Stay tuned. Start in Botswana, where the main opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, BPF, is expressing concern about what it says appears to be politically related arrests of opponents of the administration. It's also calling on the Southern African Development Community, SADC, to monitor the human rights situation in the country. It comes after two members of the party were recently arrested by the state secret service. Civil society groups warn that politically related arrests will undermine democracy in Botswana. But supporters of the ruling party reject the criticism. They say the accusations are an attempt by the opposition to generate public sympathy and to reduce support for the government ahead of next year's general election. For more reaction about the recent arrests and calls for SADC to monitor the human rights situation in the country, VOA's Peter Clody reached out to Dr. Kolatamo Koli Malefo, his Secretary for Health for the Botswana Patriotic Front.
We've been having political harassment of Botswana Patriotic Front activists. This has started, if you recall, we had a by-election over last weekend, which the Patriotic Front won against the government or the ruling party. And now they've come in and they've started all this witch hunt, and that they're using the Secret Service, which we call here the DIS, the Directorate of Intelligence Services, that they're using them to harass us. So yesterday they took two of our patrol and then detained them for about 3 to 4 hours and then released them. And then last evening, they came and took one of our patriots again, and he spent his night in jail. And this morning we tried to locate him. They can't avail him to us.
But some people are suggesting that if they are alleged to have committed a crime and the police or the DIS officials are investigating, what should be the problem? There shouldn't be a problem, should there?
Usually there would be no problem if they were saying there was a crime. But remember that in Botswana, the intelligence services talks about national security threat. And if you have an offense that you've created otherwise, if it's criminal or otherwise, it is not for the secret service, it's for the police. So we know the reason that they are doing this is not because there's any criminal offense that has happened. It is because they are just harassing, because they've got the power to detain people for 48 hours. And it's to cause intimidation and to harass their political activists. If you go and be interviewed, if there's any criminal offense, you must be told. And then you could get legal advice and all this. So this morning, we're not allowed to see him. The lawyer went to see them. They refused to talk to the lawyer. So this is abuse of human rights.
Supporters of the government have denied allegations made by opposition groups such as yours of the political space being shrunk to the use of state institutions, including the police and the judiciary or the security apparatus, to clamp down or intimidate and harass opponents of the administration. They flatly deny that.
Let me say that at the moment, we have no issues with the police, but we are being harassed by the secret service of government. And they are using those to actually harass the opposition activists. They detained two of our members. This morning, they were harassing two of our officers from the Youth League, asking about party matters. Really, what is secret service has got to do with party matters? And what do they have to do with the Youth League of a political party? It's got nothing to do with government. And
why would they be involved in a security threat? Don't you expect the Secret Service to delve into it, investigate, to find out where the threat is coming from?
If there is a security threat, you're right. But what I'm telling you is that, so the BPF youth, what security threat are they posing? The youth of a political party, how can they cause security threat? But how is it security threat that the Youth League complained against a party president? How does that threaten national security?
So what do you say to those who are of the view that the opposition is just creating what they call a publicity stunt just to make the government unpopular?
But I would put it the other way. So are they hiding behind the US-Africa summit so that they harass people and they detain people for no good reason? And then claim that we're trying to tarnish the name. No, we really have got no interest in the US-Africa thing. In any way, it's not doing anything for us as the ordinary citizens of this country. It's only pushing the agenda for the bourgeoisies. So it is not for us. But they are the ones who are detaining people during that. They could have waited until they finished that thing and then started to harass it. But no, they are the ones that have done it so that amidst all these celebrations they're having, then people could miss this harassment. The thing is, we are sure that because they have corrupted our president in the Botswana Patriotic Front, they don't want us to remove our leader, not even for them, our leader, so that they can continue to sponsor and derail our agenda.
That was Dr. Kolatamo Koli Malefo, Secretary for Health for the Botswana Patriotic Front. He was speaking with Peter Clotty from Habarone.
The FIFA's Women's World Cup 2023 is set to kick off in Australia and New Zealand with four African teams. This week on Our Voices, we'll take a closer look at the upcoming Women's World Cup games and see if FIFA will keep its promise to be more inclusive and pay big money to their female players. Join the conversations Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
Representatives of Sudan's warring factions have arrived in Saudi Arabia's city of Jeddah to resume talks aimed at ending the crisis in the country. A source told Reuters it has been 3 months since fighting broke out between the army and rapid support forces, with hundreds dead and millions displaced. Previous talks in Jeddah, facilitated by Saudi Arabia and the United States, were suspended by both countries in early June after numerous ceasefire violations. Saudi Arabia and the U.S. have yet to confirm the resumption of talks between the warring factions. A new report is calling on governments in East Africa to develop the second-hand clothing market in order to foster innovation and competition in the textile industry. The report, which was commissioned by the Mitumba Consortium Association of Kenya, focuses on the second-hand clothing industry in the East African community. The study was released last week as trade ministers met in Nairobi for the 54th All-Africa Trade Ministers Meeting of the African Continental Free Trade Area. Local textile manufacturers have often complained that importing the clothing, also known locally as mitumba, has a negative impact on textile production in the region. Professor Patrick Diamond of Queen Mary University in England is the author of the report. He tells me that both the second-hand clothing sector and the local textile industry are complementary to each other.
Yeah, so I think they're complementary partly because of the point I was making about recycling and the new technologies that are emerging. So the opportunity to reuse existing clothing in new ways, Secondhand clothing that comes into the country will at some point reach the end of life and need to be recycled. And that's an opportunity for new domestic textile producers. But also, you know, the skills that are being used are in some ways complementary. Whether you're dealing with secondhand clothes or you're dealing with new domestic textile production, there's a lot of emphasis on quality, on the kind of skills, on being able to present clothes in ways that are attractive to the consumer. So in that sense, you know, whether it's marketing, whether it's design, whether it's cleaning and presenting clothes so that they're attractive to shoppers, there are lots of ways in which, in fact, the two sectors are very complementary.
And what are some of the laws and regulations in East Africa that you would characterize as impediments or barriers on secondhand clothing businesses?
Yeah, so I don't think there's anything at the moment which is a regulatory barrier to setting up Mutumba businesses. I would say, though, that there is a case for perhaps having more government involvement, creating more of a structure around, in particular, the Mutumba markets. I mean, I think there is a concern in some quarters that the markets are not very well organized. There are risks in terms of security, also fire safety and so on. So I think there's a strong case for having better regulated marketplaces, which also protect standards for workers, because we want Mutumba traders to be able to deal in secondhand clothes in a way that is not going to be a threat, obviously, to their own safety or to the threat of those who are shopping in their markets. So I would say there is a strong case for having, yeah, more government involvement in terms of regulating how the markets are working. And I think that would be good for the traders, but also good for the consumers and shoppers.
Mm. And how would any restrictions on this trade violate any global trade agreements?
Well, none of this would violate global trade agreements, because it's nothing to do with trying to stop the flow of goods in and out of East Africa. And I think, as you inferred earlier, of course, one of the big problems of banning secondhand clothing would also be that you would, in effect, violate existing trade agreements, including, of course, the AGOA agreement, which would lead to very costly penalties for countries in East Africa. But what I'm proposing is nothing to do with trying to reduce the flow of free trade. It's simply about having better organized markets within countries, which are sort of good for the consumer and good for workers, because, you know, Mutumba has an enormous contribution to make. But I think when you observe some of the markets, it's clear that they're perhaps not as well organized as they could be. And this is perhaps an area where local government, municipalities, as well as the national government could step in just to introduce a bit more regulation to ensure that we have those standards that are so important.
So this report is being released at the time when African trade ministers are meeting in Nairobi, Kenya. Was there a worry on your side or on people in this industry that that they might be coming up with some of these regulations to either ban the importation of Mutumba?
Yeah, of course, there's concern, because as you rightly say, we know that these issues are being discussed among ministers. And there is, I think, always a temptation to say that banning secondhand clothing would be a radical solution that would lead to certain benefits like reviving domestic textiles. But I mean, our view would be that we think we have the arguments on our side. We believe that the economic evidence suggests that banning secondhand clothing will not help the domestic textile industry. And I think ministers will in time understand and accept the evidence on that. But I would also say that I think trade ministers and ministers in governments will ultimately proceed cautiously, because they will recognize that if they do undertake steps to weaken the Mutumba trade, this will have a very detrimental effect on jobs at a time when, as you know very well, in all countries around the world, there is more and more pressure on employment because of the economic circumstances after COVID and with all the things going on in the global economy. And I just think ministers would be very cautious about undertaking measures, putting in place regulations which actually damage employment at a time when we need more better jobs, particularly for young people and for women in our society.
That was Professor Patrick Diamond of Queen Mary University in England. He's the author of the report on the secondhand clothing industry in the East African community.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter. Turkey drops its opposition to Sweden joining NATO. We examine the outcome of the NATO summit as the alliance expands in the face of implacable Russian aggression. Former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Jim Townsend and Catherine Sendak of the Center for European Policy Analysis discuss the summit takeaways, far-reaching implications of the NATO summit, next, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is Nightline Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, the banned political party PUDEMO says it is committed to continuing the struggle for more democratic reforms in the southern African country. This as the opposition party marks the 40-year anniversary of its founding in 1983. The party has been fighting for years to end the use of state institutions, including the security services and the judiciary, to clamp down on its activities. However, it says it will continue to press home the demand for peaceful democratic change where citizens will have the opportunity to choose their own leaders. But supporters of the government say the group and other pro-democracy activists use violence and terrorism to destabilize the country and make it ungovernable, accusations they deny. Eswatini, Africa's absolute monarchy, bars political parties from participating in elections. For more about the party's future prospects, VOA's Peter Cloti reached Maxwell Dlamini. He's the national spokesperson for PUDEMO.
So this month we were celebrating that milestone and all the achievements and tribulations that we have gone through in the past 40 years and the contributions that we have made in the socio-economic and political development of our country. So we are actually pleased to have this opportunity as a movement and also the people of Swaziland to look back at what we've actually achieved over the years and also recommit ourselves into the final creation of a democratic multi-party state in Swaziland.
What would you say has been the major achievement of PUDEMO since its formation 40 years ago?
Well, the first major achievement for PUDEMO is the constitution of 2005, you know, in Swaziland. It was one of the key demands, you know, of PUDEMO when it was formed in 1983 to campaign and call for a constitution in Swaziland, because Swaziland did not have a constitution since 1973 when the then King Sopoza III, the King Sopoza II, banned the political parties. So we've been able to pressurize government and also lobby the international community to force the government of Swaziland to put in place a constitution for the country. Although we still have some misgivings about some sections of the constitution that continue to outlaw political parties, but that is a key achievement. Another key achievement is the issue of building, you know, trade unions and social movements, as well as civic society organizations to organize our people and galvanize them around the socio-economic injustices in the country. You know, we look with pride that we have been able to form the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland. We look with pride that we have been able to establish the Swaziland National Union of Students. We look with pride that we have been able to play a key role in the formation of the Swaziland Rural Women's Assembly, which is an organization that we have mobilized and galvanized and educated our people.
Critics of PUDEMO say that all what PUDEMO has been doing is terrorism, attacking state institutions, clashing with security forces, organizing protests to undermine the territorial integrity of the Kingdom of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland. So your organization basically has been terrorizing the kingdom. Your response to that since its formation, basically?
Well, the government proscribed PUDEMO as a terrorist entity in 2008. But as I speak of today, a number of our leaders and our members have been charged with terrorism, but none have ever been convicted in the court of law. As we speak now, there are over 40 people in prison that have been charged with terrorism, and none of those people that have been arrested are members or even linked into the People's United Democratic Movement. And even the international community have refused, you know, to actually to go with what the government of Swaziland is saying or proscription of PUDEMO as a terrorist entity, because they understand that you're a movement that believes in dialogue into a negotiated settlement to resolve our problems in Swaziland. We are a movement that has refused, you know, to be drawn into violence, as well as extreme terrorist means, you know, to express our political ideas and ideals, as well as our ideology. So we distance ourselves from all those forms of terrorist entities or terrorist activities in the country, because we are a movement that does not abide with those aims and objectives of expressing ourselves in extreme and violence means.
Where do you see PUDEMO in the next few years?
Well, PUDEMO is going to consolidate, you know, and coordinate, then unite all Emaswati for the last mile of our freedom, you know, our last mile, you know, towards freedom, where we are going to be able to defeat Tingunda system of government and the royal regime and put in place a constitutional multi-party democracy. So we are going to be a leading movement in uniting all the Maswad and all the progressive forces to unleash the final punch into the regime and force it, you know, into bringing about those key change that you need in the country. But beyond that, Swaziland is going to play, PUDEMO is going to play a key role, you know, in the transformation of our country, in the new democratic society, in putting in place alternative, you know, policies or developmental policies to improve the socio-economic condition of our people, in making sure that quality education is accessible, is affordable, is of high quality, putting in place a health system that is responding to the needs of our people, in improving the economy, in engaging the world and also the continent.
That was Maxwell Dlamini. He's the national spokesperson for the opposition PUDEMO in Eswatini. Studies show that Africa's space sector is steadily expanding, with over 20 countries establishing national space initiatives and plans to launch more than 100 additional satellites by 2025. And some believe Africa lags behind in the space race and should do more. Ethiopian-American veteran space scientist Dr. Brooke Lacu, who is a former associate director for Planning and Research and Development Solar System Exploration Division at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, tells me that even though space exploration requires many resources, it is necessary if Africa is to become less reliant on foreign technology and take control of its own environmental and national security.
Now, a question that many people ask, I think, is part of a wider debate of the U.S. and other developing countries spend billions of dollars for space exploration. And they're asking, is there justification to spend that much resources to go to the moon and other places in space when there's a lot of suffering? There's so much need for the resources here on Earth. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I've thought about this issue. Africa needs to be in space. There's no choice, in my view. Being behind in that area costs African nations quite a lot. For instance, for communication, for telephone, for education, remote education to their provinces and stuff, they pay hundreds of millions of dollars rent to get the bandwidth from private satellites and so on and so forth. Even, you know, if you look at that, it'd be enormous saving if they had their own communication satellite. And also now, with the miniaturization that I mentioned, you have CubeSats. They're like 10-centimeter cube. Mm. And that's one unit. You can have a 6U where you can have quite a few things. And that you can
is that what we hear when we, for example, like Uganda sent a satellite to space recently, and Kenya?
Kenya did one.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, what's different about the Kenyan satellite, it was built by engineers from a private company in Kenya. That's a departure from
the private sector investment in space in Africa is happening.
And was launched by SpaceX.
Yeah.
And so that's very early stage, but it should be encouraged. I think Africa is wasting quite a bit of resources through internal wars and stuff. You know, I'm not saying it's only in Africa, because wars happen around the world, as we know now. But leaders should make every effort possible to avoid these things and focus on what's important for the future. Being present in space is controlling your own financial transactions, controlling how you grow crops from space. You can map, you can see where moisture is low or high and so on and so forth. It's even important for national security. So it's not a choice. You have to be there. And to do so, I think, regional cooperations, yes, like Kenya has on San Marco Island, a launch pad that Italians use. It's near the equator. As you know, when you launch from the equator, you get the Earth rotates faster at the equator, so you get all that velocity attached to it. And so, you know, the launch could be in Kenya, the satellite could be assembled in Uganda, some of the electronics could be done in Ethiopia and so on. And
research happens some other places.
It's safe. Yes, absolutely. It's not prohibitively difficult anymore.
Right. I mean, prohibitive in terms of resources could be, but when you pool resources, I guess.
Absolutely.
But is Africa falling behind the space race at this point? Is that something that worries you?
It worries me, yes. Nigeria has done several iterations of space launch. For instance, they hired an English company that did their first satellite. They had their engineers go in England to work. But now they're gradually moving the control center in Nigeria and then doing some of the work in their own. So there's a lot of not highly organized Africa-wise, but these countries are trying.
That was Dr. Brooke Lacue, the former Associate Director for Planning and Research and Development, Solar System Exploration Division at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. He joined me in studio here at the Voice of America. You're listening to Nightline Africa on the Voice of America. In Malawi, religious groups say that the constitution does not support same-sex marriages. In a series of protests across the country, church and other religious groups demonstrated to show their disapproval to what they call an attempt by an individual to challenge the constitutional ban of same-sex marriage. Representatives at the demonstration in the capital, Lilongwe, say it was aimed at reaffirming and supporting heterosexual relationships. It was attended by prominent Malawians, civil society, the opposition, and some cabinet members. Organizers say that a majority of Malawians are against same-sex relationships, which they say is alien to their culture. They add that Malawi is a conservative and family-oriented country whose laws must be respected. Opponents say that LGBTQ people have always existed, but until recently have not spoken out publicly, and that they are no threat to society. Archbishop Desmond Tambala led the protest in Lilongwe. In an interview with VOA's Peter Clotty, he dismissed suggestions that the protests are aimed at pressuring the judiciary to ban same-sex relationships.
Well, it's actually to make a statement about the stand of the church on same-sex marriages, same-sex marriage. That's the heart of the message. The statement was made that for the churches, for us, we believe that the marriage should be between a man and a woman. That was the statement.
But is that in doubt? Because that is what the Constitution states. So why would the religious groups, including churches, decide that, okay, we are going to demonstrate to reinforce the stance? So what's the need for it?
Well, because of late, we have noticed bodies, groups that are also agitating on the same, but also some citizens, one citizen actually, who is not Malawian, who went to court here in Malawi, seeking to move the courts to pronounce that he can be married to a man. He's a man and he wants to get married to another man. So this is already a matter which is here in the courts of Malawi. While we do not want to go into a court case, because that's a matter of the course, we thought it was important to reinforce what, as you say, is not in doubt for us.
Archbishop Tambala, what has been the reaction so far of Malawians about same-sex marriages?
It has been massive no And this is across the country. I have not yet met a Malawian who is in favor of it.
Archbishop, some people are suggesting that what two consenting adults do in private should not be concerned to other Malawians.
I thought about that. For us, if it is going to move the course to change the law, then it will affect all of us. The law does not only apply to one or two individuals. So if it is in private, when they do things in private, well, that's their business. But when now it comes into the public forum, as it is already in the courts, and then I think that's no more a private issue, and we need to make a stand. Because there's a difference between what people do in private and when they go out to legislate it, to ask the courts or the parliament to legislate it for everybody. Because a law applies to all of us. It's not only what those who are doing their own in private. No, at this level, we are talking about the public. So that's where I think there's a difference. We needed to make a statement because we feel that we also stakeholders, we need to be heard if it comes to the law.
And activists are suggesting that perhaps this demonstration sends a signal to judges who will be adjudicating this legal challenge that, hey, we are here, you better rule in our favor, else we'll deal with you.
I think that's not true. We have never thought of that. And actually, we have a very independent judiciary in Malawi. I think that should not be underestimated. They have demonstrated over time that they are very independent. What we have done is we have also been involved in the case because we have our lawyers who have applied to be friends of the court, interested to the case, and they are there. So I don't think that's an issue. Here we are talking about a matter that is being debated in the public. And in debating whether it is in the course or not, I think the public have a right to debate, to express themselves. So I think tying it to the court case is not fair at all. And regarding the fact of trying to intimidate the judges, I think people have to come to Malawi to understand that our judges cannot be intimidated.
So what is the overall message, and will this protest continue in the foreseeable future?
At the moment, what we are telling, especially the MPs, is that, and also the other stakeholders, that we should guard our family. Actually, the banners that we carried around is at the middle of the family. So we want to see that whatever happens in the future is protecting the family between a man and a woman. That's all. As to what we are going to do from now onwards, no, we are very respectful of the executive, the legislature, the judiciary, but also the legislature. If this comes to them, because as of now, it's in the parliament, they have said that it has not yet been presented there. We respect those bodies, and let us wait and see. As they say, we'll cross the bridge when you come to the bridge.
That was Archbishop Desmond Tambala speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from Lilongwe in Malawi.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists has found that the color of the ocean has significantly changed over the last 20 years. They add that this is likely due to human-produced climate change. The team, made up of U.S. and U.K. researchers, detail their findings in a study published in the journal Nature. The team proposes that tropical regions of the ocean have been getting greener over the years. The researchers say that while the color change may not be as noticeable to human eyes, the shift nonetheless has affected over 56% of the world's oceans, which they say is an area larger than Earth's entire landmass. Study authors suggest that changes in color show that marine ecosystems at the ocean's surface must also be changing, since ocean color is an actual reflection of the organisms and materials contained within its waters. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Is the Voice of America. You're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, our sports report, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. And now it's time for Nightline Africa Sports.
Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The stage is set for the 2023 FIBA AFROCAN Final, which will pit Morocco against Cote d'Ivoire in a clash between outsiders who have now become title contenders on Sunday. Morocco and Cote d'Ivoire have never faced each other in the AFROCAN history, while Morocco qualified automatically to this year's AFROCAN by virtue of reaching the semifinals 4 years ago. Cote d'Ivoire went through a regional qualifier last month in Abidjan to make it to the Luanda Showdown. Mike Fofana, Cote d'Ivoire's force, says the team will put away its individual brilliance to work together to win against Morocco.
I don't really feel nothing about the individual. I feel it's a team. Without my team, I wouldn't be able to do none of the things I'm doing out here. Coach said this is a team. There's no one star. Everybody's together. We all play for each other. We all have fun. We all love each other. This is bigger than just one person. This is for our country.
In tennis news, Tunisian Ons Jabeur on Saturday described her third defeat in a Grand Slam final as the most painful of her career, but vowed to bounce back and break her jinx at the majors. World number 6 Jabeur was beaten 6-4, 6-4 by unseeded Markéta Vondroušová of the Czech Republic 1 year after she lost the Wimbledon final to Elena Rybakina. More pain followed at the US Open later in the year, where she was runner-up again, this time to Iga Swiatek. It may be the hardest loss of her career, but the heartbroken Ons is confident these losses will teach her how to one day win this final.
Said, I cannot force anything right now. It wasn't meant to be. It wasn't. This match, last year's match, the final of US Open, will teach me how to win these finals, and we'll definitely keep learning, keep being positive, and I think that's the thing that will keep me going.
And now to rugby, where the Kenyan national under-20 rugby team, the Chipu, began its World Rugby under-20 trophy campaign on a sour note after going down 34-25 to Samoa at the Nyayo National Stadium on Saturday. The Kenyans landed the first try after a bright start, but the two-time champions Samoa hit back almost instantly to even the score. In the earlier games, Zimbabwe were demolished 64-33 by Scotland as the Barclays Cup champions came up short in their opening match of the campaign. The teams would take a 5-day break and resume the champions on Thursday, the 20th of July. In boxing news, former boxing champion Floyd Money Mayweather is in South Africa after attending a political event in neighboring Zimbabwe. Floyd Mayweather and the hashtag The Money Team are in South Africa as part of the Motherland Tour. His banquet in Johannesburg will help raise funds for young people involved in boxing.
It's great to be back in Africa. My first stop was Zimbabwe. Any and every time I come back, they treat me with respect, show me nothing but love. I always want to inspire and push my people, let them know they can be great like myself.
And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports.
Thank you so much, Samson. Always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up again next Sunday for another look at African sports right here on Nightline Africa. It is Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
If I be your only girl, you must like my ways. Baby, you go love my craze. You must run my race. Oh, I'm the one for you, you, you. Man, play, I think I go left for you, you. Anything I do is for my baby, boo. Give for you. Anything I would do, can do. He loved to make me the lazy, oh, the lazy, oh. A DVD that he do the toe. And it's only you that makes me alright. What would I do without you in my life? See good things that you bring for my life. Baby, it's only you to make me high. Come give me love like a king, oh.
wanna deny, I don't wanna see you. It'll make me go to door to door, and I want to open up the door. My heart is cut to cut to cut for you.
We met a beautiful girl, no bada bada. Mkwano ya guleka, she no one, no bada bada. Oh, Musadu ya Yori nakalema. Yesu viso mkwano, muna katele gulema. Mkwano kwa hika, nakalema, nakolima.
side, it not be everybody sabi dance. So why they do this song to teach you the basic step? I say make you not be fear, run to the dance floor. Let's do as I do, and we go have a lot of fun. So jump to the center, move one leg like this.
Espebas, Nyata. Gaela Tikaya la patrona. Gilda Sambendengesu. Mon ami Gaël, Miloito. Sana kozela to change o to komi na bokoko bokolanda baril ya petrol ache le mongo chemin na motoari Michel Mbungu PDG Félicien Pamou Victor Evanja Yohan Sibai César Kuka, ouvre-toi, oui, et Toka, PDG, Dragon de la Monnaie, Michael Mwanga, Lebon Dindaouba, Iya, Pedro Piranha, Estelle Senge, Gino, Igwe, Ursus Moula, Kamina, Chakumbae.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle and producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no shortcuts exist to the top of the palm tree. I'm your host, Jackson Vunganyi, in Washington.